Hello and welcome back to UEG Journal Podcast, your quick dive into the latest and most impactful research in gastroenterology. I am Dr. Mohsin Subbani, trainee associate editor with UEG Journal and a gastroenterologist based at Nottingham University Hospitals, UK.
And I'm Maria Manuela Estevinho, trainee associate editor of the UEG Journal and a gastroenterologist and professor in Porto, Portugal.
We are back for the latest episode with a very special guest, and we're pleased to welcome Dr. Yusuko Maeda. She is associate editor with UEG Journal and consultant colorectal surgeon at Queen Elizabeth University Hospital, Glasgow.
Welcome on board, Yasuko.
Thank you for having me today. I'm looking forward to discussing paper with you.
Thanks, Yasuko. Would you like to tell a bit more about yourself?
Sure. So as a colorectal surgeon, my speciality is IBD surgery and particularly proctology. So things we're going to be discussing today, like perianal fistula, hemorrhoid, pilonidal disease, those are my specialities. And I also do general surgery, which includes emergency surgery.
Excellent. So you're the best person. So today we'll be talking the first article, which is talking about autologous adipose tissue injection in treatment for ileoanal pouch related fistula. So just to start with, this study was actually evaluate whether patient with ileoanal pouch related fistula would benefit from autologous adipose tissue injections. So we'll be discussing this in detail with our guest, and hopefully we'll get some insights for our audience.
Exactly. In this study, investigators included 21 patients with ileal pouch anal anastomosis and 29 fistulas. Adipose tissue was harvested from the patient via a small liposuction procedure and was injected then around the fistula tract. Patients who did not achieve healing after the first injection could then undergo repeated treatment, and the follow-up period was around 16 months. Before coming to results, I would like to ask you, Yasuko, do you manage pouch complications regularly in your surgical practice, right? And from your perspective, how significant is the problem of pouch-related fistula, and how challenging are they to treat with current approaches?
Thank you. So yes, I do manage some pouch complications, and it's not only limited to fistula. It could be stenosis, chronic pouchitis, or functional problems such as evacuation difficulties or incontinence. So there are a number of issues, but here we're talking about pouch-related fistula. So in general, any perianal fistula involving the sphincter muscles is challenging to manage, and fistula associated with an ileopouch are probably among the most complex. This is because we often refer simply to a pouch, but in reality, every pouch is unique. Its configuration, most of them are these days J-shape, but still the length of the J, the anastomosis, the cuff lengths, how it is positioned, whether the mesentery is at the top or the back. And sometimes it changes over time. We now see a quite voluminous pouch over here because it probably stretches. And I think some patients may initially have been diagnosed with indeterminate colitis or even ulcerative colitis, which later proves to be Crohn's disease with ongoing inflammation, and it becomes difficult to keep sepsis at bay. So the first thing to do when managing any sort of pouch fistula or a sepsis relating to it is to drain it. And we manage it by making an incision or inserting a seton. Seton is a thread or vascular tape you may have seen, used to keep the tract open just to ensure drainage. But after that, we can think about a definitive treatment. And I think nearly all the treatments used for idiopathic fistula, so sort of general or standard fistula, have also been tried for pouch-related fistula. And some of them include things like fibrin glue, advancement flap, fistula plugs, videoscope, laser, and many other options. I think really the main challenge is whether for idiopathic or pouch-related fistula is the sphincter involvement. The most definitive cure for any fistula is to lay the tract open, but dividing the sphincter risks incontinence. So while preserving sphincter function, we must ensure adequate drainage and somehow eradicate the fistula. And that is the central difficulty with this treatment.
Excellent introduction, Yosuko, so for our audience, autologous adipose tissues contain mesenchymal stem cells and regenerative factors that may support healing. So from surgical biological endpoint, what do you think about the rationale behind using this in this clinical context?
So because of the challenges I mentioned earlier, and also considering the anatomical space in which we operate, so treatment is inherently difficult for this condition. So for example, even in normal anal canal, the internal anal sphincter is only a few millimeters thick. And then the space between the internal and external sphincter is just a few millimeters more. So we're therefore working within an extremely confined space. And then in addition, fistula tract often fibrosed or still has some inflammations, which are very difficult to handle as tissues. So from a surgical perspective, I think any treatment that's meaningfully improve symptom is welcome. And that is the bottom line. If I may add another surgical point, fat injection has been used for a range of indications, and many people are familiar with its role in cosmetic surgery for tissue bulking, but it is also known to soften scar tissue. So whether this benefit arises from mesenchymal stem cells that is in the fat tissue or from regenerative or growth factors is unclear, but surgical experience over many years suggests that fat grafting can be beneficial. In terms of the underlying science, I do not think the mechanism has been fully elucidated. As you mentioned, some have proposed a regenerative effect. However, evidence from many fields, not limited to fistula treatment, shows that regeneration does not occur automatically. It requires specific biological conditioning, such as oxygen level or nutrients. So for that reason, it may be overly optimistic to assume that injected fat cells simply or a stem cell simply grow into sphincter muscle or mucosa. I think a more plausible explanation is a paracrine effect, whereby processed fat contains not only mesenchymal stem cells, but also growth factors and other bioactive components that may promote healing or stimulate local cells. I think we're still quite far from understanding exactly what triggers a successful response.
Thank you for this explanation, Yasuko. And, the reported healing rates are quite promising, especially when repeated injections are allowed. And how do you believe that these results compare with other treatments that we currently use for pouch-related fistula, for example, Seaton's, advancement flaps, or revisional pouch surgery?
Sure. So aceton is a temporalizing option. It allows us to drain sepsis, and in some complex cases where the fistula is deep and not amenable to definitive treatment, it may be the only way to control infection or recurrent infections, at least. However, it is definitely not a curative approach. An advancement flap is essentially a technique in which a small sort of part of mucosa or rectal wall is mobilized to cover the internal opening. So you stretch a tissue to cover the hole. And this can be effective, but when the rectum is inflamed, and that's often the case with pouch-related or other IBD-associated fistula, the procedure may not be feasible. And for example, in a pouch with stenosis, there's a physical narrowing, so it's not really accessible to raise a flap. Now, pouch revision is another potential option, but it is a major operation. And given that fistula formation often stems from chronic inflammation, advancing or revising the pouch may not prevent recurrence. And in addition, reoperation on a pouch is technically demanding because it lies deep within the pelvis and is frequently surrounded by dense scarring and is often not feasible in the context of fistula and ongoing infection or inflammation.
Great. So as far as I understand, this is minimally invasive and sphincter-preserving treatment. So in your opinion, which patient would have maximum benefit from it? And can you highlight any of the characteristics related to fistula when we identifying patient for this treatment?
First and foremost, I think the fistula that could be considered for this treatment needs to be well controlled. What it means is that it must be adequately drained and there's no ongoing severe infection or active inflammation, and the tract should be probably well established. And that is because when with this procedure, you inject sort of a column of fat, you create a column of fat around the fistula tract, and then you have to close the opening. So you don't want any residual brewing infection within it. And then also, in order to close that hole or internal opening, the mucosa must be healthy. So this is the most optimal curative scenario. On the other hand, from the discussion I have had with the authors group, I think the technique can also be used in a sort of palliative context, meaning just focusing on symptom control. So patient with persistent discharge or severe scarring from multiple previous operations. And, you know, these scarring could be associated with quite significant pain. So softening the fibrotic tissue or reducing inflammation through fat injection may alleviate some of the symptoms and make the condition more manageable. It may also be considered as a last resort option for patients who wish to avoid proctectomy, removing the anus completely, or a pouch excision. Many of these individuals have experienced multiple septic episodes and repeated operation, and maybe facing the prospect of removing, you know, everything altogether. And some are, however, keen to preserve it. And in such circumstances, I think this approach can be offered as a final attempt, as there's really not many alternatives at this stage.
Yes, and of course, this study was still a relatively small cohort, so we, of course, need to take that into account. And from a research perspective, what would you like to see next? Do you think that we should go to larger trials, comparative studies, or perhaps to integrate this with other therapies, for example? What do you think?
So I think you raise a very interesting point. You know, although this treatment, along with other stem cell-based therapies for fistula, has been available for decades, it is only relatively recently that it has been investigated consistently by the same group of authors across both idiopathic and IBD-related fistula. I understand that they have a large clinical trial in the pipeline, and as we gain a clearer understanding of the underlying mechanism, there may be opportunities to develop combined treatment approaches, such as biologics. But I think we just don't know at this stage.
That's great. So finally, Yasuko, as a handling editor and from your clinical practice, what do you think are key take home for a gastroenterologist? And when you dealt with the study, what was the key strengths that came out?
I think there are many positives out of this study, although, as you mentioned, it is a small pilot study. I think the simplicity of autologous fat grafting is quite appealing, particularly when compared with commercial allogeneic stem cell therapies, which are prohibitively expensive. I think they also have experience in delivering this treatment and report their data quite openly. It's a small study, but I think they've been honest with all the outcome. And I think that's particular strength in a pilot study of this nature. I think we should watch this space for long-term outcomes and hopefully further basic science studies to elucidate the underlying mechanism.
Excellent. That's great, Yasuko, and thank you very much for your insight. So let's move on to our second paper titled 10-year follow-up after 96-week treatment with pegylated interferon plus tenofovir in hepatitis D or Delta. This was a HEAD-2 study by Anika Rank et al. As we all know, the chronic hepatitis D remains the most severe form of viral hepatitis. Until recently, treatment options have been quite limited, with pegylated interferon alpha historically being the main treatment available. However, long-term impact of this treatment are less explored, and this study provides important insight in the long-term follow-up in this cohort of the patient.
Exactly. This study is a long-term follow-up analysis of the IDID-2 randomized clinical trial. In the original trial, patients with chronic hepatitis delta received 96 weeks of pegylated interferon alpha-2A, either in combination with tenofovir, diproxyl fumarate, or with placebo. For this analysis, the authors followed patients who had completed treatment and had at least one follow-up visit. In total, 107 patients were included, with 51 receiving combination therapy and 56 receiving interferon alone. Patients were then followed for a mean of around 8.4 years, allowing the investigators to assess long-term outcomes such as hepatic decompensation, hepatocellular carcinoma, liver transplantation, or liver-related death.
So what did they find? So overall, about 24% patients developed at least one liver-related clinical endpoint during their follow-up duration, but importantly, risk was significantly lower in combination treatment group. patient treated with pegylated interferon plus tenofovir had liver-related event in 14% of cases compared to 34% in single interferon-related treatment. The study also showed that virological response mattered greatly in patients who achieved undetectable viral RNA or loss of hepatitis B surface antigen had significantly better long-term outcomes. Additionally, factors such as older age, cirrhosis, higher baseline marker for liver disease were associated with worse clinical outcomes.
Yes, and another interesting observation was that HCV RNA decline during therapy and control of HBV replication also appeared to influence long-term prognosis. So even though interferon-based therapy does not achieve sustained responses in all patients, those who do achieve virological suppression seem to gain meaningful long-term clinical benefits.
What does this mean for clinical practice? Firstly, this study reinforces that virological response in hepatitis delta is clinically meaningful and it translates into fewer liver-related complications over time. Secondly, it suggests that combining interferon-based treatment with tenofovir may improve long-term outcome, even if the short-term virological relapse occurs. And finally, these findings highlight the importance of early treatment and long-term monitoring in patients with hepatitis delta-related infection, and especially those with advanced liver disease.
And as new therapies for hepatitis delta, such as entry inhibitors and other antiviral approaches, continue to emerge, studies like these provide an important benchmark for long-term outcomes and also do help us to understand what meaningful treatment success really looks like.
Absolutely. A decade of follow-up data like this is rare in this type of research and provides valuable guidance as we move towards more effective treatment in the near future.
Yes, thanks, Mohsen. So now let's move to our next paper titled 5-Year Experience of Nationwide Implementation of Colorectal Cancer Screening in Sweden, which was published in the UAG Journal recently, and this study was led by Jonas Ludvigsen. This paper evaluates the first 5 years of implementing this nationwide population-based colorectal cancer screening program across Sweden. And rather than a clinical trial, this is indeed a real-world implementation study and allows us to understand how screening programs perform at the national level.
Exactly. In terms of methods, individuals between age of 60 to 74 years were invited to participate through mailed invitation that included a fecal immunochemical test, or called FIT test. This test detects occult blood in the stool, which can indicate colorectal cancer or advanced adenoma, including few other differential diagnoses. Between 2019 and 2022, over 800,000 individuals were invited. Those with positive FIT tests were referred for colonoscopy, and outcomes were recorded in centralized national screening and colonoscopic registry. The investigator assessed participant rates, test positivity, colonoscopy adherence, diagnostic yield, and quality indicators.
And so what did they find? Overall participation was about 64%, which is quite strong for a population-based screening program. This participation was slightly higher among women and older individuals, and somewhat lower in regions with lower population density. The FIT positivity rate was 2.7%, and of those with a positive test, around 82% then underwent colonoscopy.
And when we looked at diagnostic yield, the results are clinically meaningful among those who underwent colonoscopy after a positive FIT. Colorectal cancer was detected in about 6.6%. Advanced neoplasm, including advanced adenoma and cancer, was found in nearly 30% of cases among these positively detected patients. The adenoma detection rate was close to 50%, which reflects strong colonoscopy performance. Quality indicators were reassuring as well. Adequate bowel preparation around 98% of procedure and high cecal intubation rate and relatively low complication rates.
Yes, and in terms of limitations, of course, we need to take them into account. This analysis reflects early implementation, and some regions were still scaling up in the program. We can see here that colonoscopy adherence, while good, did not reach ideal targets and varied by sex and region. Also importantly, this study does not provide long-term outcomes, such as stage shift or mortality reduction. And of course, part of the study period overlapped with the COVID-19 pandemic, which may also have influenced participation patterns, of course.
So what are the implications of a clinical practice? First, this study demonstrated that a nationwide FIT-based colorectal cancer screening program is feasible and effective in routine care. And I'm aware, UK, there is a large set of data which they're looking into cut off the FIT, and that would be interesting to look at. Second, it highlights the high-quality colonoscopy infrastructure, which is essential to support such screening programs. And third, it underscores the importance of addressing disparities in participation and follow-up to maximize the population level benefit.
Yes, overall, Sweden's first 5 years provide an important benchmark for countries planning or refining their national colorectal cancer screening programs, showing that real-world implementation at scale can indeed achieve strong participation and also a very meaningful diagnostic yield.
And as long-term data emerge, we will better understand the full impact on colorectal cancer incidence and mortality.
So that's all for today's episode. Thank you all for listening to us, and we will see you next time for another deep dive into emerging research in gastroenterology published in your favorite journal.